Thank you, Mr. Irvin. Good afternoon again to everyone. It's air conditioner weather. I hope yours is working. Recently, I had a question asked, why do we read the book of Ruth on Pentecost? And this brought to mind a subject that I wanted to cover today. And so to begin this subject, I want to turn to the book of Matthew in the New Testament. And I want to take a look at the genealogy of Jesus Christ. If we look at Matthew 1, and I'm going to refer to verses 1 through 17 and point out a few in particular. And in this list, in Matthew 1 and verses 1 through 17, we read the genealogy of Christ. And in this list, we have the physical ancestors, we find the names of five women. In verse 2, we have listed Tamar. In verse 5, we have listed Rahab. And also in verse 5, we have listed Ruth. In verse 6, we have listed Bathsheba, not by name, but by description. And then in verse 16, we have the name of Mary. And when we examine the lives of these five women, we can't help but wonder as to why these five women were listed when so many other women were also the ancestors of Christ and were included in other parts of the Bible. What did these women have in common? And if we think about it, under normal circumstances, these women would not have been there. Normal circumstances, boy meets girl, they get married, they start a family, and live out their life. Ordinarily, none of them, under ordinary circumstances, would have been in the lineage of Jesus Christ. Well, today we're going to examine the life of a woman who was integral in the lineage of Christ, but her name doesn't appear here. However, her story is parallel with that of the third woman on the list, Ruth the Moabitess. The title of today's message, What Kind of a Naomi Are We? What kind of a Naomi are we? It was 26 days ago we enjoyed the day of Pentecost. It's theorized that God delivered the tablets of stone engraved with the Ten Commandments to Moses on Mount Sinai on the day of Pentecost. It's a long-standing Hebrew tradition that the book of Ruth was read on that day of Pentecost. And the book of Ruth is a delightful story. It's a story of hunger and plenty, a life of life and death, of sadness and joy, of romance and heartache, and of a challenged inheritance, and ultimately ending with filled with hope and opportunity. There are those who've been in the church for many years, and they may have heard references to this remarkable woman, Ruth, that how as a stranger in a foreign land, she was transplanted into the nation of Israel, and she represents our hope and opportunity to be in God's family. She represents God's mercy in calling all of us to his work, for God welcomes us into his family. But as much as the story of Ruth is delightful, today I want to focus on this other woman in the book of Ruth, the woman named Naomi. For the story of Naomi is woven into the story of Ruth, but Naomi has a different story. Naomi was an important mother in the history of Israel, and as we examine the story of Naomi, we'll also gain an understanding of a remarkable father named Boaz. We can keep this excellent example of Boaz in mind as we consider that Father's Day is tomorrow. So let's turn then to the book of Ruth to learn more about this woman, Naomi, and see how she is a model for us today. And let's start in Ruth in chapter 1 and verses 1 and 2. Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to dwell in the country of Moab, and he and his wife and two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, the name of his wife was Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to the country of Moab and remained there. There's a lot that's said in these two verses. A time setting is a generation after the children of Israel came into the Promised Land and conquered Jericho. And then they claimed the land of Canaan. And after wandering for 40 years in the wilderness, the Israelites had inherited that Promised Land. The land was subsequently divided into 12 tribes among the 12 tribes of Israel. And that's why there's a reference to Bethlehem, Judah. It refers to the town of Bethlehem in the area of land that was granted to the tribe of Judah. So in our case, you might say Cave Springs, Arkansas. in this land, as it were, for further identification. It may be that the man Elimelech referred to in Ruth chapter 1 was a brother or cousin to Salmon, the Israelite who married Rahab, the innkeeper's daughter, who had hid the Israelite spies when they scouted out Jericho prior to the fall of Jericho. Naomi was Elimelech's wife. They were Israelites of the tribe of Judah. They came from Bethlehem, and when the famine arose, Naomi went with her husband to Moab. Now, Moab is a country that's about 30 miles from Bethlehem across the Jordan River. Traveling at about 1 to 2 miles an hour on the journey was several days on foot, especially if you carry along all of your earthly possessions. If we stop and think, let's see, 30 miles from here would put us to the other side of the city of Fayetteville, if we were to walk. So it would take a while if you're carrying everything you owned or had a cart or whatever. It would take a little while to get from one place to the other. But apparently there was vegetables and crops grown there that they could survive. The Moabites were descendants of the patriarch Abraham's nephew Lot. So they're moving to a land that had some relationship to the Israelites. If we read in Genesis 19, verse 37, the firstborn, meaning of Lot, bore a son, firstborn daughter, bore a son and called his name Moab, and he's the father of the Moabites to this day. So there's a relationship there, Lot being Abraham's nephew. But unfortunately, the Moabites did not worship the true God. But Elimelech moved his family across the Jordan to the country of Moab because of the famine in Bethlehem. In Ruth chapter 1 and verse 3, Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left and her two sons. That's a pretty difficult circumstance. 14 years ago, my father died, and I was devastated. My father was a delightful and a gentle and devoted man. I had a hard time envisioning what life would be like without him. Yet I was a grown man living on my own, but I still felt deeply the loss. How much more so did Naomi feel the loss of her husband? She and her husband and children were living in a foreign land that wasn't so far away in physical distance as we see distance today. But Moab was far away from the fellowship of the believers of God. It's not that they were simply strangers, but foreigners worshipped other gods. I know when I have moved to a new area, it's been important to me how far would I be to the nearest church congregation. It's always been a factor into where I would move. I was raised in South Central Minnesota, an area that was settled by pioneers in the late 1800s. My ancestors were pioneers that came west as far as they could by train. Then they took a wagon pulled by oxen and they went another 20 miles or 15 miles west. They staked their claim out on a homestead. They dug a sod hut into the side of a hill. They planted potatoes and wheat, and they built a log cabin in following years, and the family expanded. And over the years, more settlers came, and they populated the area. They built a neighbor one-room country schoolhouse. They built country churches and a creamery, a place for processing milk and separating out the butter. And there was one of those creameries about every 3-4 miles apart. A small rural community developed, and other rural communities developed as like polka dots through the area. Well, by the time I came along, 3 and 4 generations later, families were well established. Everyone knew everyone else for miles around, for generations. Farms were held in the same family for generations. And ever since those families held the farms ever since the original homesteads. We knew the farms by their various names. There was the Rettman Place, or there was the Otto Farm, or the Platt Farm, or the Schmidt Farm. And if a stranger came in and purchased a farm, the farm was still referred to by its original name. I remember the Benson family came from the city, and they purchased the Bunkie Farm from Herman Bunkie's widow. Yet for the next 40 to 50 years, what do you suppose everybody called the farm? It was the Bunkie Place, not the Benson Farm. And I suspect it's similar in your neighborhood if you live in a rural area. Everyone knows who the stranger is, even if the stranger has lived there for 50 years. They're strangers because they weren't born there. And I can't help but think it was the same way in Moab. In Ruth chapter 1 and verse 4, now they, meaning the sons of Naomi and Elimelech, took wives of the women of Moab. The name of one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth. And they dwelt there about 10 years. Verse 4 tells us that Naomi was gone from Bethlehem a long time. She and her husband left Judah many years before and raised two sons to adulthood. The father, Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. The sons didn't go back to Bethlehem or to Judah to get wives. They married local girls. And the widow Naomi lived on with her sons and their wives for 10 years. There's a small town in Minnesota called Silver Lake. It has about 2,000 residents. It's located next to a small lake on the prairie. And this town of Silver Lake holds the distinction of being the town in Minnesota with the most residents having been born there. 95% of the people now living in Silver Lake were actually born there. People can move out, but if someone moves into town, you can be sure that everyone knows who they are, even to this day. I can imagine it was also like that in the area of Moab, where Naomi lived. Everyone knew that Naomi and her sons were strangers in the sense that they weren't born in Moab. When Naomi's and Elimelech's sons married outside of Israel, and this is an example of what I would call the law of unintended consequences. When you think that you have everything planned out quite well, and then something happens unexpectedly. In the case of Elimelech and Naomi, they probably didn't intend to stay for so many years in Moab, but I suspect they didn't intend for their sons to marry local girls who were outside the tribe of Judah. But that's a consequence of moving outside of the land of Judah. So if we take a look in Deuteronomy 7, in verses 1 through 7, we read those instructions about moving into the land of Canaan and the surrounding areas. And if we take a look in verse 2 in the last part, you shall make no covenant with them. Verse 3, nor shall you make marriages with them. You shall not give your daughter to their son, nor take their daughter for your son, for they will turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. So the anger of the Lord will be aroused against you and destroy you suddenly. Well, the principle espoused by Deuteronomy 7 was that Israelites weren't to marry outside the nation of Israel. They could wind up worshiping other gods, and then they would suffer severe consequences. We can glean from this passage that we're cautioned not to marry outside the faith, lest our spouse and in-laws draw us away from God. But let us continue with the story of Ruth. With Naomi's husband, Elimelech, dead, the sons didn't have their father to arrange marriages for them from the wives back in Judah. And if we look back at Ruth in chapter 1, in verse 2, we read the words, and continued there. So they stayed there. And it has the implication that, well, they were well received in Moab, they were treated well, and it may be that they intended to stay there permanently. And of course, people marry the people that they know. With limited transportation, the pool of marriageable people was much smaller than perhaps today. People married those who were within the day's journey. In my own family, among ancestors, my grandfather is one of three sets of double cousins. This occurred because two Martin's brothers and one Martin's sister all married into the same neighboring family, the Platt family. Two Platt sisters and one Platt brother married the two Martin's brothers and the one Martin sister. The two families were neighbors. The children went to the same nearby school. They attended the same neighborhood country church. The children grew up and married from the pool of people they knew. And then the three young married couples all had children who had cousins to each other on both the mother's side and the father's side. As a result of those three sets of double cousins, the Martins and Platt clans are forever intertwined. And that would have been the case if Naomi's sons would have continued to live and have families in Moab. Their children would have become Moabites. They would have been forever separated from the nation of Israel because marriages join families. But there was a happening that changed everything. In Ruth chapter 1 and verse 5, then both Mahlon and Chilion died, so the woman Naomi survived her two sons and her husband. If we refer back to Deuteronomy 7:4 that we read earlier, the implication here is that both sons died suddenly. There was a consequence. Something happened. They both died. And this is a tragedy beyond words for Naomi. Without her husband and sons to support, she was left in a strange land. There was no Social Security check coming in for her each month. There were no survivor's benefits for a life from a life insurance policy, no relatives to look after her. Naomi was in a terrible predicament. And we read on in Ruth 1 in verses 6 and 7. And she, meaning Naomi, rose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the country of Moab that the Lord had visited his people by giving them bread, meaning back home in Israel. Therefore she went out from the place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. Naomi was in a predicament. She wanted to make the best decision that she possibly could under the circumstances. She knew that she would receive some care under her relatives back in Bethlehem, the people she knew where she would be accepted. And Naomi recognized that unless she left Moab, she was otherwise stuck in a foreign land among strangers that worship foreign gods. So let's read on then in Ruth in chapter 1 and verse 8. And Naomi said to her daughters-in-law, "Go, return each to her mother's house. The Lord deal kindly with you, as you've dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each in the house of her husband." So she kissed them, and they lift up their voices and wept. All three women here were crying. This was goodbye. They knew they would not see each other again. You see, there was no telephone, there wasn't a fax machine, no postal service, no internet, no Pony Express, no messenger service. There were no planes, trains, or automobiles to take them back and forth for visits. This goodbye was expected to be permanent. And notice in verse 8 the phrase, "Go each return to her mother's house." In the Middle East culture and throughout Asia and much of the rest of the world, when a girl was married, she left her father's household and joined her mother or her husband's household. She would no longer be considered part of her father's house. Her inheritance was with her husband. In the case of Ruth and Orpah, in verse 8, the mother's house is mentioned. Now, it's possible that the girls' fathers may have already died, and their mothers were now under the care and responsibility of their brothers, of the girls' brothers. And Ruth, then, if we read in chapter 1 and verse 10, "And they said to her, 'Surely we will return with you to your people. In verse 11, "But Naomi said, 'Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Are there still sons in my womb that they may be your husbands? Turn back, my daughters, go, for I'm too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, if I have a husband tonight, and should also bear sons, would you wait for them until they were grown? Would you restrain yourselves from having husbands? No, my daughters, for it grieves me very much for your sakes that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me.'" Naomi was explaining that even if she got married that very day and conceived a son that night, it was not realistic for Ruth and Orpah to wait 20 years, the age of adulthood for young men, for Naomi's new sons to be ready for marriage. Ruth and Naomi were likely in their 20s, possibly 30, and Naomi was probably already past childbearing. But even if it were possible to have more children by the time new sons from Naomi were born and raised, Ruth and Orpah would have been middle-aged and possibly past childbearing. Now let's turn to Deuteronomy 25 for an understanding of the Levirate law of marriage that Naomi was referring to in verses 12 and 13. Naomi was saying, well, would you wait for the sons, for more sons, if I have them? So let's read in Deuteronomy 25, starting in verse 5. "If brothers dwell together, and one of them dies and has no son, the widow of the dead man shall not be married to a stranger outside the family. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her as his wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. And it shall be that the firstborn son which she bears will succeed to the name of his dead father, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel." Verse 7, "But if the man does not want to take his brother's wife, then let his brother's wife go to the gate of the elders, and say, 'My husband's brother refuses to raise up a name to his brother in Israel. He will not perform the duty of my husband's brother.' Then the elders of his city shall call and speak to him, but if he stands firm and says, 'I do not want to take her,' then his brother's wife shall come to him in the presence of the elders, remove his sandal from his foot, spit in his face, and answer, and say, 'So it shall be done to the man who will not build up his brother's house.' And his name shall be called in Israel, the house of him who had his sandal removed." In other words, it was the responsibility of the surviving brother to raise up a child in the brother's name. And this is what really what Naomi was referring to, is that, well, if I had a son, you know, then you could marry the son. But you're not going to wait around 20 years for that to occur. Something similar to this, as I've mentioned, has happened in my family, where my grandmother's my grandfather died, and my grandmother married my grandfather's brother. I didn't know this till I was a teenager, and finding out that, well, the same last name, the same relatives, the same everything else. I just heard sideways comment from older neighbors about how it was a marriage of convenience of my grandparents. It was very puzzling to me. They seemed like wonderful people. They got along well. It was grandpa and grandma, and it was a contractual business relationship. But I heard the neighbor say, whoa. It took a while, and I think I was 12 or 13 before I realized that the one I called grandfather was actually my grandfather's brother. And yet, it was all very convenient, as I came to later learn, that great-grandfather called my grandmother and the remaining son into the and had a chat with them and said, you need to marry the farm back together. The brothers dwelt together, and they married the farm together. And were married for another 50 to 55 more years. It's a remarkable story, and I can't help but think of this example in the Bible. Well, the inheritance of the tribes of Israel was to remain in the various families. And in order to preserve the family's land intact, to keep the land from being sold outside of the family, there was this Levirate principle explained in Deuteronomy 25. A male relative of the husband was to become the husband of the widow and raise up a son in the dead husband's name in order for the inheritance to remain within the family. Presumably, then, the next son born would be the inheritor of the then of the husband, but the first son would carry the name of the elder brother. In the case of Naomi, Ruth, and Orpah, Naomi had no husband, and even if she did, she was likely past childbearing, wouldn't have more sons. And even if she did, it wasn't reasonable that Ruth and Orpah would wait 20 years to marry a man less than half their age. And Ruth, in chapter 1, in verse 14 through 18, and they lifted up their voices and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, meaning Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. Now, it's not particularly common that many mothers-in-law and daughters-in-law have a close and loving relationship, as Naomi and Ruth did. Instead, there's often competition between the mother-in-law and the daughter-in-law over the attention and affection from the man they hold in common, the son of one and the husband of another. In fact, there's a lot of mother-in-law jokes that have nuggets of strife and contention at the core of the joke. You probably heard about the definition of mixed feelings. That's where someone sees their mother-in-law drive over a cliff in their brand-new Cadillac. Well, these jokes are kind of everywhere like this, where there's because of this tension that exists in many families. We have a daughter in Japan who has learned Japanese and was describing to us the kanji script of the image of peace, and that would be a little drawing of a house with a woman in it. And then she showed us the kanji script or the image of war, which would be the same house with two women in it. So I couldn't help but think of Ruth here. They seem to get along, and this is great. And Ruth, in chapter 1 of verse 15, Naomi said, look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. Verse 16, but Ruth said, entreat me not to leave you, or to turn back from following off after you. For wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God my God. And where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more so, if anything but death parts you and me. Ruth is making a commitment right here. And this is the model of the commitment that we make to God when we're converted and baptized. We make this same pledge of faithfulness to God as modeled by Ruth's commitment to Naomi, that nothing but death will part us here. And this is as Ruth is saying, wherever you go, I will go, your people, my people, your God, my God. And Ruth, then, in chapter 1, and verse 18, when she, meaning Naomi, saw that she was determined to go with her, She stopped speaking to her. In other words, Naomi quit trying to convince Ruth to remain in Moab. She recognized that her daughter-in-law was stuck on her, that they were going to be dwelling together. And this is the lesson that's often emphasized at Pentecost, that we're to welcome those who choose to obey God, to accept whom God is calling to become part of his family. Pentecost is the holy day God has set apart for welcoming those who were previous strangers and welcoming them into the fellowship of God. In verse 18, Naomi quit trying to convince Ruth to stay behind in Moab. Ruth was determined to stay with Naomi and live a different style of life than was practiced in Moab. We move on to verse 19. And now the two of them, meaning Naomi and Ruth, went until they came to Bethlehem. And it happened when they came to Bethlehem that all the city was excited because of them. And the women said, "Is this Naomi?" Now, I suspect that this has happened throughout the ages when people haven't seen each other for a long time, because people change over time. I know I've said that about someone who I haven't seen for many years. And people have looked at me and said, "What happened to you?" Well, 5 years ago, my beard wasn't as white as it is now. And it's likely the same for other people. Well, you sure look different. So Naomi was gone for years. She likely looked older. Perhaps she had grayer hair. She had now no husband. She was a widow. She didn't have her sons with her. They had died. And there was a foreigner with her, a Moabitess woman. It's no wonder at first glance that people were surprised by Naomi's appearance in Bethlehem. When they say, is that really so-and-so? I know I've gone to my hometown and I've gone to the grocery store and there's somebody I haven't seen since high school. And I take a deep breath and I think, do I look to them like they look to me? Gulp. And Ruth, then in chapter 1 of verse 20, what did Naomi respond to the people that knew her? She said, "Don't call me Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt bitterly with me. I went out full," meaning with a husband, and possessions and sons, "and the Lord has brought me home again empty. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has afflicted me?" Now, the difference between the two names, of course, Naomi is pleasant and Mara means bitter. So in one case, she went out pleasant, and the other case, she said, "Just call me Mara, call me bitter," when she came back. You see, when Naomi and Elimelech departed, they were landowners with a heritage, and Naomi did the right thing as far as what she saw to do. She followed her husband to a new land, the land of Moab, and the land fed Naomi and Elimelech and their sons for many years. And although the death of Naomi's sons was heartbreaking, she was then deeply stricken with a sense of loss. And that talks to each of us in our lives, and from time to time we get bitter about a serious sense of loss in our lives, just as Naomi did. But let's continue with the story of Naomi and Ruth. In chapter 1 of verse 22, "So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law with her, who returned from the country of Moab. Now they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest." So they came back in time for this harvesting. And now we go to chapter 2 and verse 1. "And there was a relative of Naomi's husband, a man of great wealth of the family of Elimelech. His name was Boaz." Now the word relative means kinsman redeemer. And if we go back to Deuteronomy 25 that we read earlier, there is this, says the husband's brother, meaning male relative. The closest qualifying male relative were a kinsman who had the right to redeem the heritage for the deceased, meaning Elimelech or his son. So there was somebody there who was a kinsman redeemer. His name was Boaz. Verse 2. "So Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, 'Please let me go to the field and glean heads of grain after him in whose sight I may find favor.'" Now, they didn't have Social Security. They didn't have food stamps. They didn't have a lot of programs. There was no help for utilities and so forth. But there was a responsibility. For those who were the kinsman redeemer in the family, there was a responsibility to take care of all of the unmarried women in the family, whether they be widows or single gals. And so when the eldest son inherited the property, he also inherited the care of his mother, his widowed mother, and any other aunts or any other widows or sisters in the family. And all of a sudden, a kinsman redeemer took the care of having the legal responsibility for caring for those that were related. And what does Naomi say in verse 1? Go, my daughter. And because Ruth said, let me go glean. She had some knowledge of this. She said, well, in other words, I'm entitled to glean in his field. May I go do this? And in chapter 2, verse 3, then she left Ruth and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the family of Elimelech. Now we read in Leviticus 23 that the Israelites were instructed to leave some of the land to be harvested by those who were landless or destitute. In Leviticus 23, verse 22, when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of your field when you reap, nor shall you gather any gleaning from your harvest. You shall leave them for the poor and for the stranger. I am the Lord your God. So this was so that people who didn't own the property were able to come and harvest. Now, gleaning means, when they glean, it means picking up after the harvest. And every time you have a harvest, there's always something that gets missed. And oftentimes in the corners is one place that it is. Particularly true with machinery, but apparently it was true then as well. When Ruth is gleaning in the field belonging to Boaz, it appears that Boaz was a godly man following the instructions of Leviticus 23. Let's read on in chapter 2, verse 4 of Ruth. Now behold, Boaz came from Bethlehem and said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." And they answered him, "The Lord bless you." So Boaz had employees. Then when Boaz saw Ruth, his curiosity was piqued. Verse 5, then Boaz said to his servant who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" His curiosity was arose. You know, this girl is a young lady is out here gleaning. Verse 6, so the servant who was in charge of the reapers said, "It is the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. And she said, 'Please let me glean and gather after the reapers among the sheaves.' So she came and has continued from morning until now, though she rested a little in the house." Boaz didn't forbid Ruth from gleaning, which he could have done because she was a Moabitess, but he didn't do so. Actually, he made arrangements then for Ruth's safety by inviting her to continue to glean in his fields. In verse 8, Boaz said to Ruth, "You will listen, my daughter, will you not? Don't go to glean in another field, nor go from here, but stay close by my young women. Let your eyes be on the field which they reap and go after them. Have I not commanded the young men not to touch you? And when you're thirsty, go to the vessels and drink from what the young men have drawn." So they brought water to the harvest field, and he welcomed her to glean right there on the field. And he clearly gave instructions, "Don't mess with this young lady. Just leave her alone. Let her glean." In verse 10, so she fell on her face and bowed on the ground and said to him, "Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me, since I am a foreigner?" Now in Strong's, it's 5237, means an alien, or could mean an outlandish stranger, an outlandish woman, an unusual person to be in that place and time. Accommodating strangers or foreigners was dangerous business, and yet Boab just didn't arbitrarily welcome just anyone to glean on his property. He had done a background check on this foreign woman, Ruth. Verse 11, Boaz answered and said to her, "It has been fully reported to me that all you've done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, and how you left your father and your mother in the land of your birth, and have come to a people whom you did not know before. The Lord repay your work, and a full reward be given to you by the Lord God of Israel, under whose wings you have come for refuge." In other words, you've come to under the refuge of the Lord God by coming to Judah. And Boaz was going to make sure that he was following that instruction. And Ruth was appreciative. Verse 13, and she said, "Let me find favor in your sight, my Lord, for you've comforted me and have spoken kindly to your maidservant, although I'm not like one of your maidservants." In other words, she wasn't a hired gal. She wasn't one of the household of one of the servants. She was a foreigner. Boaz then invited Ruth for a meal. Verse 14, now Boaz said to her at mealtime, "Come here and eat of the bread and dip your piece of bread in the vinegar." And she sat beside the reapers, and he passed parched grain to her. I don't know, is that oatmeal or barley soup? I don't know. And she ate and was satisfied and kept some back, leftovers, for her mother-in-law, Naomi. Then Boaz made special arrangements to help Ruth glean even more grain than she would normally be able to glean. In Ruth chapter 2, verse 15, when she rose up to glean, Boaz commanded his young men, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves. Do not reproach her. Also let grain fall from the bundles, fall purposely for her. Leave it that she may glean, and do not rebuke her." In other words, making sure that this kid was well taken care of. Verse 17, so she gleaned in the field until evening and beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. She took it up and went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. So she brought out and gave to her what she had kept back after she had been satisfied. Now, I don't know exactly how much that is, but if she carried it herself, I do know that a bushel of wheat weighs 60 pounds. A bushel of corn weighs 56 pounds. Barley, I presume, is somewhat close to wheat. I don't know how big an ephah is, but I know what a bushel is. But she had to be able to carry it. So we read on in verse 19, and her mother-in-law said, "Where have you gleaned today, and where did you work? Blessed be the one who took notice of you." So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked, and said, "The man's name with whom I work today is Boaz." Now, verse 20. Now we get into the backdoor chit-chat. Then Naomi said to her brother-in-law, "Best be he of the Lord who has not forsaken his kindness to the living and the dead." And Naomi said to her, "This man is a relation of ours, one of our close relatives." Why would Naomi say, not forsaken his kindness to the living and the dead? Well, Naomi and Ruth were of the living. The dead were their deceased husbands, of whom he was a relative. Now, we read on in verse 21, Ruth the Moabitess said, "He also said to me, 'You shall stay close by my young men until they've finished all my harvest.'" Well, there's a reason for that, because wandering on alone for a young woman is probably not the safest thing in the world. And Boaz instructed her to stay close to the young men. He had instructed the young men not to bother her. And nobody's going to mess with the boss when that's what the boss says. So verse 22, and Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It's good, my daughter, that you go out with this young woman, and the people do not meet you in any other field." So she, meaning Ruth, stayed close by the young women of Boaz to glean until the end of barley harvest and wheat harvest, and dwelt with her mother-in-law. So we have this now relationship where Boaz is spreading his wings as taking the responsibility for both Ruth and Naomi. Ruth in chapter 3 in verse 1, and Naomi, her mother-in-law, said, "My daughter, shall I not seek security for you that it may be well for you? Now Boaz, whose young women you were with, is he not a relative? In fact, he's winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor." This was normally done by the owner of the property. There was a flat, beaten area of threshing floor, meaning a pounded flat clay, and usually on a hilltop. They would take and beat out the grain as best they could, and then take forks or shovels and throw it up and let the wind carry the chaff away, and the heavier grain would fall. And the owner would stay there and sleep by the grain, because that was his livelihood. That was his potential gain. And so he would stay right there at the threshing floor, so nobody hauled off the grain. He could personally be in charge of that. In chapter 3, in verse 1, Naomi and her mother-in-law said to her, "My daughter..." In fact, I just passed that. Now, Boaz, whose young men you were with, is he not a relative? In fact, he's winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Therefore, wash yourself, anoint yourself, put on your best garment, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he's finished eating and drinking. Then it shall be, when he lies down, you shall notice the place where he lies. You shall go in, uncover his feet, and lie down, and he'll tell you what you should do. Ruth, in chapter 3, verse 5, and she said to her, all that you say to me I will do. Naomi was making a plan. If you're going to be, if the kinsman redeemer is going to exercise his responsibility, you have to make yourself known to him for that, that you're available for that purpose. And Ruth Ruth said, okay, I will do this. So verse 6 in chapter 3, she went down to the threshing floor, did all that according to her mother-in-law instructed her. And after Boaz had eaten and drunk, his heart was cheerful. And he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain, and she comes up softly, uncovers his feet, and lay down. Now it happened at midnight, the man was startled, so he sound asleep. And he turned himself, and there was a woman lying at his feet. And he said, who are you? She answered, I'm Ruth, your maidservant. Take your maidservant under your wing, for you are the kinsman redeemer, also known as close relative, meaning of her dead husband. Now, I've had experience where I woke up in the middle of the night and things weren't as they appeared to be. Something was terribly wrong. I remember waking up and I wanted to scratch my nose. And you know, the brain, you're half sleeping. I told myself, go ahead and scratch the nose, but my nose didn't get scratched. So I thought, well, I had left arm is supposed to scratch my nose, and I didn't do this, and I'm really tired. There's something terribly wrong. So I reached over, why isn't that arm working? And I used my right arm, and I couldn't find my left arm. This was terrible. Now I'm really, really tired, and I'm reaching, and I can't find it. And the brain isn't fully oxygenated, and I'm thinking, oh, no. Somebody stole my arm. My arm is gone. I'm really tired. And so I've got to find my arm. I sit up sharply in bed and I reach severely around to get it. And I twist my body and there's still no arm there. So then as I twist back, this arm comes flying up around me and whacks me in the head. It was all numb and sleeping. And now I was sure there was somebody in the room with me mugging me because I had this strange arm wrapping around me. And now I'm panicking, and I jump out of the bed, and I realize, because I reach back for the arm again, and it's still gone. And, well, I jump out of the bed, and I'm panicking now. The heart starts racing. This is a very unusual experience. And I thought, oh, no, this arm, it's dead. I've laid on it, and there's no blood. I'm going to lose the arm. Oh, no, what are your panic thought? They're going to have to amputate. What's going to happen here? And so I thought, well, how do I get the blood flow? Well, I have to exercise quick, get the heart rate up. So I'm running in place next to the bed and excited, and I'm hollering. Of course, my wife thought I was absolutely crazy. I understand that. But it was a panic. And so I can understand things aren't as they seem. When you wake up, what's wrong with this picture? And Boaz wakes up, what's wrong here? What's this? There's somebody at my feet. And I can imagine he's at midnight, and of course it's all dark. And so now we read on in verse 10. Boaz says, blessed are you of the Lord, my daughter, for you have shown more kindness at the end than the beginning, that you did not go after young men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you request, for all of the people of my town know that you are a virtuous woman. Now it is true that I am a close relative. However, there is a relative closer than I, meaning a kinsman redeemer, somebody who had a prior right to the redemption of Elimelech's property. Stay this night, meaning at my feet, and in the morning it shall be that if he will perform the duty of a close relative for you, good, let him do it. But if he does not want to perform the duty for you, then I will perform this duty for you as the Lord lives. So lie down until morning. Verse 14, she lay at his feet until morning, and she arose before one could recognize another. And he said, do not let it be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. Well, that would certainly be awkward. Somebody came to the threshing floor and slept with the boss. That's just not a good plan. Verse 15, he said, also bring the shawl that is with you and hold it. And when she held it, he measured 6 ephahs of barley and laid it on her. Then she went into the city. Well, before she gathered 1 in an entire day, and now he loaded her up on the threshing floor with 6 units. However much that was, she had to be able to carry it in her apron or cloak, whatever it was. Verse 16, when she came to her mother-in-law says, is that you, my daughter? And she told her all the man had done for her, and she said, these 6 ephahs of barley he gave me and said for me, do not go empty-handed to your mother-in-law. Ruth, verse 13, chapter 3 and verse 18, then she, meaning Naomi, said, sit still, my daughter, until you know how the matter will turn out. For the man will not rest until he has concluded the matter this day. In other words, she knows men well enough. He's not going to sit still. He's going to make this happen. He's going to find a conclusion one way or the other. Now we go to chapter 4 and verse 1. Now Boaz went up to the gate, and this is a place where official decisions are made, or the agreements are ratified in public. Boaz sat down there, and behold, the close relative of whom Boaz had spoken came by. So Boaz said, come aside, friend, sit down here. So he came aside and sat down, and he took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, sit down here. So he has witnesses. He's got the other kinsman redeemer here. He's got 10 witnesses of the elders of the city, decision makers. And they sat down, and he, meaning Boaz, said to the close relative, Naomi, who has come back from the country of Moab, sold the piece of land which belongs to our brother Elimelech. And I thought to inform you, saying, buy it back in the presence of the inhabitants and the elders of my people. So, you see, if they buy property or sell property in that time, it would revert to the original family at the end of 50 years. This would be the Jubilee year. So really what you're buying is how many crops left to harvest on that property. So it appears that Elimelech sold the property with the expectation, a societal expectation, it would revert to the family after 50 years. And I thought to inform you, Boaz says, buy it back in the presence of the inhabitants and the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, redeem it. But if you will not redeem it, then tell me that I may know, for there is no one but you to redeem it, and I am next after you. And what did the man say? He said, I will redeem it. Now, in real estate transactions, we call this the right of first refusal. Someone has a right to purchase a piece of property, and the right may or may not be exercised. The right of first refusal can also be sold or inherited. Many years ago, I purchased a piece of property through the right of first refusal. My father had the right to exercise his option to purchase a piece of property, but he declined to do so. So I purchased the right of first refusal from him, and then I bought the property in his place. Well, in the present case of Boaz and the purchase of Elimelech's property by a relative, there was a catch. And isn't it that way when it seems that we're faced with a deal that's too good to be true? So what's the deal too good to be true here in Ruth chapter 4, verse 5? And Boaz said, on the day that you buy the field from the hand of Naomi, you must also buy it from Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance. In other words, this is the catch. If you buy the land, you've got to take the wife that goes with it to raise up offspring in the name of Elimelech and Elimelech's son. Now, verse 6, what does the close relative say? I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I ruin my own inheritance. Because then his firstborn son would be of the Elimelech nine and not his own. He said, you redeem the right of redemption for yourself. I cannot redeem it. Because he apparently didn't do the background check on Ruth to know the virtuous woman that she was. All he knew is that he was going to wind up marrying a Moabitess woman, a stranger. Not a good plan if you haven't done your homework for someone who he didn't know. So the unnamed man was worrying that Ruth the Moabitess would upset his own lineage. His first son would not be considered his own, would rather be an inheritor of Elimelech and Naomi. The law of primogeniture is the right of the firstborn to inherit a double portion. If we take a look in Luke 15 and verse 11, we can read about this law of primogeniture. In Luke 15:11, Christ is giving a parable, and he said, "There a certain man had two sons, and the younger of them said, 'Father, give me the portion of goods that falls to me,' and he divided to them his livelihood. And he said to him, 'Son,'" now this is the case of the prodigal son, and there were two sons. The elder son would get a double portion. So the younger son, that means they would take of two sons, they would divide the property three ways. The eldest son gets two portions. The younger son would get one portion or one third of the property. And so the father did. He divided and he gave one third of the inheritance early, before he died, to the younger son. And then, of course, we know the story of the prodigal son who went out and wasted that entire third of the inheritance. Now let's read on in verse 31 of Luke 15, where the father said to the eldest son, "Son, you are always with me, and all that I have is yours." He couldn't split it anymore. Everything would go to the eldest son in this case. So the law of primogeniture, the firstborn would inherit the double portion. Now we go back to Ruth in verse 7, in chapter 4 and verse 7. Now this was the custom in former times in Israel concerning the redeeming and exchanging anything. You know, when a man takes off his sandal, he would give it to another. That's a confirmation in Israel. In other words, well, I will I'll tell you how I do it in my classroom. If somebody wants to borrow a pencil, I will lend them a pencil, but they will give me a shoe as collateral. And when they give me the pencil back, I will give them a shoe back. Where do you think I got this idea from? Well, you got it right here. I get my, and you know, I've never failed to get a pencil back. I've never had a student go walking one shoe on, one shoe off, leaving the classroom. It's been working for years, and everybody knows it. Oh, I forgot a pencil. Please, will you let me not do a shoe? Nope, nope. Put it right, perch it right up high. Everybody can see it. Well, this is what we have here. We have this contract, this deal, where the shoe is coming off as a confirmation. In verse 8, we have the close relative said to Boaz, "Buy it for yourself." So he took off his sandal, and Boaz said to the elders and all the people, "You're witnesses this day that I have bought all that was Elimelech's and all that was Chilion's and Mahlon's from the hand of Naomi. Moreover, Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, I have acquired as my wife, to perpetuate the name of the dead through his inheritance, that the name of the dead may not be cut off from among his brethren and from his position at the gate. You are witnesses this day." This is basically a public wedding. It was immaterial that the bride wasn't present. The legal issues were all resolved right there. This was like filing the certificate at the courthouse. This was a public proclamation. Everybody knows it. This is the way it is. Verse 11, "And all the people were at the gate." Now, do you suppose there were more than one observer by that time? I suspect people were gathering around. Whoa, we got something coming down here. Look what's happening. "And the people were at the gate, and the elders said, 'We are witnesses. And the Lord make the woman who is coming to your house like Rachel and Leah, the two who built up the house of Israel, that you may prosper in Ephrathah and famous in Bethlehem. May your house be like the house of Perez, who Tamar bore to Judah, because the offspring which the Lord will give you from this young woman.'" The implication is that Boaz was an older man. Now, if we read the ancestry of Boaz, he was the son of Rahab. So you may tell why he is, and his father was Salmon. You may know why that may be, why he's not married. Because he's the son of a Canaanite woman, and who's going to arrange a marriage with somebody who's, you know, not of the tribe of Israel. So I can understand that nobody was in a hurry to marry their daughter off to Boaz because of that relationship to the land of Canaan. And you can also understand then why Boaz would have a kind heart towards someone who was raised in Moab, who would understand what it felt like because his mother was not a native Israelite. Ruth chapter 4, verse 13. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went to her, and the Lord gave her conception. She bore a son. Interesting verse 14 now. We're getting into the Naomi part. Then the women said to Naomi, "Blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a close relative, that his name may be famous in Israel, that he may be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age, for your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is better to you than seven sons," meaning has borne him. Then Naomi took the child and laid him on her bosom and became a nurse to him. And also the neighbor women gave him a name, saying, "There is a son born to Naomi." And they called his name Obed, and he is the father of Jesse, who became the father of David. Verse 18, now this is the genealogy of Perez, and it goes through the son of Judah, Perez, and so forth, all the way on down the line to Salmon, to Boaz, to Obed, Obed to Jesse, and then Jesse to David. Now, what are the traditional lessons that we learn from the book of Ruth? Well, the first lesson is God calls whom he will into the knowledge of his truth. We read in John 6:44, "No man can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and I will raise him up the last day." So, first point on the traditional lessons of from the book of Ruth, God calls whom he will into the knowledge of the truth. Point two, we're to welcome those whom God calls. In John 13, verse 34. In John 13, verse 34. "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another as I've loved you, that you also love one another. By this all will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." The people that are willing to follow God are our brethren. And our obligation and responsibility and our love for God is demonstrated by loving those whom God calls. So point two is we are to welcome those whom God calls. Point three, we must avoid being a stumbling block to those whom God calls to his truth. We must avoid being a stumbling block to those whom God calls to his truth. In Romans 14, in verse 13, in Romans 14, 13, "Therefore let us not judge or condemn one another any more, but rather resolve this, not to put a stumbling block or cause to fall in our brother's way." So in order to love someone, we need to avoid putting a stumbling block, whether on purpose or by accident, in front of someone. Point four, not only are we to recognize whom God calls, to love and care for them, to avoid putting a stumbling block in their path, but number four, we're to actively assist them by being helpers of their joy. If we take a look in 2 Corinthians chapter 1, of verse 24, 2 Corinthians 1, 24. The Apostle Paul writes to the church in Corinth, "Not that we have dominion over your faith, but are fellow workers for your joy, for by faith you stand." So we stand shoulder to shoulder with those who have been called by God, not just to hang around and be there in case they need us, but helpers of their joy. Now I want to take a look to summarize the life of Naomi, and I want to compare that to our lives in the church. You see, from all appearances, Naomi tried to do everything right, but tragedy continued to strike. Number one, Naomi married within the faith, and she had two sons. A famine arose and they were hungry. The second point, we find that Naomi went with her husband even though he took his family to a foreign land. She was faithful to her husband and dedicated to her children. The point three in the summary of the life of Naomi, Naomi's sons married outside the faith, outside the tribes of Israel in that foreign land. Point four, Naomi did her best to have a good relationship with her daughters-in-law, and they both clearly loved her and respected her and wanted to be with her. And one of those daughters clung to Naomi and moved to that distant land with her. And how many daughters-in-law have that especially close relationship with their daughters-in-law, as did Ruth and Naomi? The fifth point in Naomi's life, when widowed and then bereft by the death of her sons, and there was no one left to care for Naomi in Moab, she decided to journey back to Bethlehem. The sixth step, Naomi then actively guided her daughter-in-law in the ways of the nation of Israel. In other words, do this, don't do that. Watch this pattern, follow this custom. Verse 7, through Naomi's husband's kinsman, Boaz, Naomi was able to have a legal son to claim her husband's inheritance and to care for Naomi in her old age. You see, that was the true Social Security, is that someone was there to come after to take care of them. And now they were calling this Naomi's son because it was a relative of Elimelech, then to replace the sons that she had lost. And so she was named at that time, or they said that this baby wasn't just Ruth's son, it was also Naomi's. So when Naomi suffered because of a famine, God used the perseverance of Naomi to bring Ruth into the fellowship of Israel. God used the good example of Naomi to show it was possible for Ruth to become converted to the true God. And God preserved the story of Ruth and Naomi as an example for all time. In fact, the story is so important that the physical lineage of Christ is recorded as coming through the union of Boaz and Ruth, the marriage that was made possible by God and facilitated by the love and the diligence of Naomi. So the question of the day is simply this: what kind of a Naomi are we? How many of us have spent years and years doing what we know to be right? Going to church, keeping the Sabbath, the annual holy days, praying, fasting, tithing, following God's dietary laws, doing our best to show love to our families and to our brothers and to our neighbors, and being good stewards of the blessings that God has given to us. Like Naomi, did we do what we were supposed to do, even if imperfectly? But everything didn't always turn out well. Did we start out being pleasant, meaning the definition of Naomi, and later become bitter, which is when Naomi said, "Call me Mara," when hard times came upon us? So we ask ourselves, what kind of a Naomi are we? Are we doing everything that God expects of us? Are we living patient and godly lives in a manner that others, who may be strangers to God, are so taken by our example that they want to leave their gods behind and seek the true God? Look at the qualities that Naomi demonstrated, that we might be like her in our influence upon others. The example of Naomi causes us to consider how to be prepared to welcome the future Ruths in our life. And we can be prepared to bring those who were once strangers, to welcome them into our congregations, to make them part of our families, to love them as God loved us and brought then us into his family. Without a loving and caring Naomi, it's hard to imagine there would have been a Book of Ruth. For our own benefit and the benefit of the work of God, let's do our part to be the best type of Naomi that we can be.